Hey everybody, real quick before we get to today's episode, I just wanted to remind you all about Jupiter Jet Volume 2. It's by friends of the show, Jason Inman and Ashley Robinson. And I love Jupiter Jet. The Volume 1 was such a favorite of mine and my daughter, who at the time was 6 years old. And she loved it so much, and we really bonded over it. The first comic that she couldn't wait to read and you know, didn't want to put down, and she even was the first person ever to cosplay as Jupiter Jet and got to meet Jason and Ashley. So that was really cool. Jupiter Jet has a special place in my heart, as you can tell. And I've read the first 20 pages of Volume 2, and it has that same really all-ages wholesome feel. You know, the first volume had that classic pulp Rocketeer feel to it, maybe mixed with a little DC Superhero Girls, and the second volume is picking up right where that left off, maybe with the stakes raised a little bit, I'll say, and Jason and Ashley always throw a bunch of twists and turns that are a lot of fun as well. So there's a link to go and check out the article on LRM Online to read more details about the Kickstarter. And there's also a link to the Kickstarter itself so you can go and support it. I highly recommend it. It's a great, fun, all-ages book. And if you have a young boy or girl, I think they'll enjoy it just as much as my daughter does. So thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Webtoon Wednesday episode. And before we dive into it, apologies. I know my voice is a little scratchy. I'm kind of battling a sore throat. But I've been looking forward to this interview for a long time, and we didn't want to delay it. My guest today is a freelance cartoonist, been on the show before. He's worked on properties like Battlestar Galactica and The Shadow as a penciler and inker for Dynamite. Along with J.D. Smith, he did the 5-issue series San Hannibal from Pop Goes the Icon. His current work is Ringo and Eisner nominated. It's a digital strip over on Webtoon called Lavender Jack. And we're here to talk about that strip as Season 2 is well underway. So it's great to have Dan Scotti back on the show.
Wonderful to be back. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dan. Before we get into the strip itself, I do want to remind everybody where they can find Dan online. He does have his own website, danschkade.com. That's danschkade.com. And he can also be found on Twitter and Instagram at Dan Scotti. So I'll put links to all the social media in the show notes, everybody. And you can go and give Dan a follow. He's very engaging on Twitter, and I do encourage you to follow his work. So let's go ahead and dive into it, Dan. I first have to ask you to remind all our listeners what Lavender Jack is about, or for any new listeners, if they're not familiar, give us an idea of what the strip is about.
Well, you said that I'm pretty active on social media, and one of the nice side effects of that is I get to see other people talking about Lavender Jack to each other, and a lot of people are pitching it to their friends. It was sort of a more obscure comic on Webtoon. You know, it's got a bit of a smaller audience, and so, you know, you don't stumble across it as easily as you might, you know, a Lore Olympus or a Let's Play. And so one of the pitches that comes up a lot is the first season is pitched as anti-capitalist Batman versus Tarzan. And then the second season they're calling Batman Bertie Wooster versus the Phantom of the Opera. And I feel like both of those are pretty good litmus tests of, like, if those nouns sound good in relation to each other to you, you're probably going to enjoy this comic.
Yeah, it has a certain charm to it. I think it's one of those strips that once you start reading it, it's really easy to get sucked in.
And then you're a fan. I feel like if you're a fan of comics and a fan of sequential storytelling, this is one of those strips. It's one of those works that's nearly impossible to dislike.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you. And I'd like to think that if I was encountering this in the wild, I'd feel the same way. It really is sort of a distillation of all the things I like best in fiction. You know, I love period pieces. I love you know, great detective Sherlock Holmes style fiction. I love really pulpy, dramatic, sort of masked men, you know, seeking justice in the night stuff. And I also like you know, mini quiches and martinis. And so it kind of has all of that together in one weekly package.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about your experience with the first season now that it's all over, and we'll also touch on season two and some of the differences. But I have to ask before we go any further, I mentioned in that intro for you that Lavender Jack was nominated as Best Web Comic for an Eisner in 2019. And anybody who's a listener of this podcast probably knows that the Eisners are kind of the Oscars of the comic book world. So that had to be just an incredible experience for you. So tell us how you found out. Tell us what your reaction was and kind of what that experience was of having that Eisner nomination.
Well, it was very unexpected and a gigantic honor. I've got a lot of respect for the Eisners as an institution. I went to the Eisners in the first San Diego Comic-Con that I ever went to. I stayed late for the Eisner Awards that Saturday night. At that time, pretty much anybody could walk into them. They're a little bit more selective now that Comic-Con's become bigger. But seeing all these cartoonists, some of whom I'd known and grown up reading, and some of whom weren't that much older than I was at the time, you know, going up on stage and accepting these awards made it seem very tangible and also very important to me. And so the Eisners have always been kind of tied into my decision to do comics in the first place, because it really validated it for me, the pursuit of comics, I mean, as a life path, I guess. So when, you know, obviously I like Lavender Jack, and I really hoped it would get some kind of recognition, but it wasn't until Bree Boswell, my editor, emailed me the night before the nominations were announced that I even knew me being nominated was a possibility. And that was, oh man, that was just magic. That was, it really felt like, it's a weird feeling of something you thought was impossible suddenly being a fact. And a lot of times that can be an upsetting, scary thing. And this time it was a very good thing. The Eisner Awards are also managed by Jackie Estrada, who's been a staple of San Diego Comic-Con for a long time. And her late husband, a guy named Batten Lash, was really the guy who taught me how to be in comics, who got me started in the industry. So that was one final sort of important layer to it. That this man who had been so important to me and who had passed away very recently, I knew that he would, I guess, I wish I'd set up the sentence in a different way so I don't say this sort of cliche thing, but I kind of thought that he'd be proud of me.
Yeah.
And that all came together to make it a very special thing.
Yeah. When I saw that, Lavender Jack, was nominated, I was really happy for you, because I know how passionate you are about the project. The other thing I felt was that it was so great because it really validated the strip. You know, when we had you on before, the strip was kind of just getting started, starting to kind of build momentum. But I thought it was something really special right from the start. And so not only was I happy to see you get recognition from your peers, but also to see that validation for the strip, and hopefully it helped to bring it to more eyes. Hopefully some people saw the nomination and said, oh, Lavender Jack, what's that? Let me go and check it out. Did you hear from any readers? Did you notice a bump after the nominations came out in readership at all?
I definitely noticed a bump in recognition from my peers. I don't know how many readers picked up on it, because there are even some some comic shop owners who don't really know about the Eisners, who don't really follow the Eisners. So they're really, it's a meaningful award for the industry. And so it was really something that made people who maybe didn't understand what Webtoon was, or who didn't really get the caliber of work that was being done on the platform, it kind of made them realize, oh, so you're really, this Webtoon thing is real,
right?
And you're a part of it.
Yeah.
And by the way, the other two Webtoons that were nominated for Best Webcomic were Let's Play and Lore Olympus, which are two of the biggest comics on the platform. So that's also what was cool was, you know, that these massive series and a sort of more niche series were recognized. Like, that really shows you that the Eisner judges were combing through this site to find the things they wanted to nominate. It wasn't a passive process.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned those two series, Lore Olympus from Rachel, and Let's Play from Leanne, also very passionate creators, also, well-deserving. You know, they've both been on the show, before as well. So, I was really happy for all three of you, really.
That's very kind of you. I was almost more excited to hear about Rachel getting nominated. Yeah, like, I was excited for myself because it was me. But I was excited that Lore Olympus was getting recognized, because I think that's such a unique work it's so 100% comics, but coming at it from an angle that you just don't see. So I was really thrilled for her when I saw that. And if I was going to lose to anybody, I wanted to lose to her.
Yeah, what's funny about Rachel too, she's the most humble, down to earth. I don't know if you've ever met her in person, but she has not at all let the success go to her head. You almost get the impression when you meet her that she feels like maybe she's dreaming and it's going to end at you know, any second. She just really doesn't understand how big it is, despite the lines that she has at shows. It's just so charming.
Well, that's great to hear.
Let's shift gears here a little bit and let's talk about the strip itself. How do you feel now that you have a whole season under your belt? You know, first of all, congratulations on a successful season one. I think it was fantastic. So how are you feeling with that season one being completed?
I'm very proud of it. The goal was always to create a season one where if we didn't get to do more, it would feel like a complete story, sort of a movie's worth of narrative. And I'm very happy with it. And in fact, because it felt so nicely self-contained, it freed us up to imagine a different direction for season two. And I think that the two seasons do have their own flavor to them in much the way that a movie and its sequel might. So of course I look back at it and I see a billion things that I would do differently, but then I also see, I don't know, 9/10 of a billion things where I'm like, oh, I forgot I'd done that. Or, hey, that's a really cool composition. Or, you know, what a neat little character moment. You can get so caught up in the momentum of wanting to improve that you kind of forget to appreciate, I don't know, the little gems you've mined along the way.
Now, if you can go back and remember when you set out to start this, I'm sure you had a plan for how the story was going to unfold, the way it was going to be plotted and paced. How much of it, what percentage? I know it's never 100%, because there's always things that change, and you want to have that fluidity as a storyteller to let things happen organically. But how much, if you could give a percentage of it, worked out like you expected it to?
I would say that about probably 75% of it worked out how I expected, and I would say about like 90% of it worked out how I would like. There are a lot of pleasant surprises along the way. You know, things like Inspector Crabbe's arc from this very, you know, square, stick in the mud, lawful good character into a more fluid character was always supposed to be, you know, a facet, a feature of the first season, but that so many people latched onto it and that I had so much fun writing it was like something I didn't plan for, but it became a much more important part in a positive way. So if anything, I think that if we completely stuck to my initial plan, it would have not been as good a season as it ended up being.
Yeah, and that always brings me to a question, and you kind of mentioned this already. You look back at it, and there's things that you think are, you know, quote unquote wrong with it, or you wish you'd done a little differently. But when you think like that, is there any part of you that says, well, if I tinker with it, though, then maybe it would lose some of its magic? Is that a dichotomy that you experience? Like, yes, maybe I would change this thing, but then who knows if it starts the dominoes falling? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good question. It's a delicate thing. And I think ultimately you have to have some humility when it comes to your own ability. You know, you might think you could go back and fix it and do it better, but you might just do an equivalent thing that goes in a slightly different direction. And this is something that comes up a lot in co-writing situations, which I've been doing on a different project. You come to realize, is this idea better than the one my co-writer has, or is it just mine? And so I feel like when looking at your own work, you have to have that same consideration. So overall, I would say, much as I'd like to go back and do like a fixed, nice director's cut, I'm happy. I'm happy with how it's at.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. You know, you run the risk of, I guess, the Steven Spielberg or the George Lucas, rather, trap. You know, you keep messing with Star Wars. It's like at some point you just got to leave it alone and let it stand on its own.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
I did also want to ask you about the characters and the plot points. Season one, you know, you mentioned how it was structured in such a way that if you only got that one season, it did feel like a complete story. Obviously, we're happy that it's continuing with season two. But were there particular characters or plot points, things that happened in the story that readers and fans responded to most? Was there anything that stands out in your mind?
I think what really stands out is the reader's response to the characters of Lord and Lady Hawthorne, or sort of our main villains of season one. And they're sort of distilled down into the idea of what if Tarzan and Jane left the jungle, went back to Europe, and then became gangsters. And initially they were just these sort of scary, unknowable villains who were sort of by design emotionally reserved so that they didn't hog too much of the spotlight and we had more time to examine our main characters. But as the season went on and you started to see more of what their marriage is like, these sort of human dysfunctions that they have, you got to see how kind of hungry and fundamentally like broken they are, that there's this unexpected sympathy for them. And I think a lot of the audience really latched on to the character of Lord Hawthorne, who they just called Tarzan, which I love. Like that was their name for him. They wanted him to die because he had done horrible things and would surely continue to do horrible things if he was left alive. But I think a lot of them held out hope that he could somehow be redeemed. He became like the Kylo Ren of the first season.
What I loved about them, you know, as we kind of learned their origin, they did become more sympathetic, and there was something that was like a charm to them, even though they were, for lack of a better term, evil. You know, their love for each other did make them relatable somewhat. But the other part of it was you didn't swing it too far. You know, so many modern villains, the attractiveness is they do live in that gray area. You maybe could call them an antagonist rather than a villain. But kind of based on sort of the setting, the time period that you're crafting your story in, it does harken back to a time where things are a little more black and white. And that's not to say that the city of Gallery is black and white. There's a lot of reflections of modern society and class, which is something that, you know, humans have sort of struggled with for hundreds of years now. But in the case of Lord and Lady Hawthorne, you didn't go too far. You didn't bring them too far into that gray area, but just enough to make them relatable and to make people care. So I'm happy to hear that a lot of the readers responded to that, because I think that they were exceptionally well done villains. And personally, I mean, I would love to see more of them at some point. You know, some kind of flashback or some kind of something, you know, a one shot with Tarzan, so to speak, would be spectacular. So something to think about for the future, I suppose.
Well, by the end of the season, I've been locked into a course where he really had to die in order for the arc to resolve satisfactorily.
100%.
Yeah. But that started becoming really hard. Like right at the end, I'm like, oh man, is there a way he can just, like, I don't know, can he be paralyzed and still be alive? Ultimately, I decided to stick to the plan there, but I love those characters so much that definitely Lady Hawthorne is somebody we've not seen the last of in the main story. And oh man, God will, I would love to do a Better Call Saul about the Hawthorns, like rising to power in Gallery. That would be awesome.
That would be really cool. But I agree with you about Lord Hawthorne. The tragedy of the character, I don't think it could have ended any other way. It's part of what made it so tragic for him. It was almost like he was a victim of circumstance. Because, you know, although we did see some of his origin, we you know, clearly not all the questions were answered.
I think he's kind of like, he's similar in some ways to Eric from the Phantom of the Opera. Like you understand his tragic past. You still don't really want him to keep strangling people, but at the end, like it's almost pitiful that he has to live this life. And I think that you can feel pity for a villain while at the same time, like, needing them to be brought to justice. I think it's one of the things that makes, for example, Mr. Freeze such an awesome villain.
Right. You can,
and you know, the wonderful death of the Green Goblin at the end of the first Spider-Man movie, where he's just like pathetically telling Spider-Man, like, you know, don't tell my son I'm the Green Goblin, and then he dies. If you can hit those notes, I think you can really activate something special in the audience.
Yeah, you can dislike what they do while not necessarily disliking them, because you understand how they could become that kind of warped version of humanity.
Yeah. Well, then what's the point of being a hero, being a good person, if bad people are some other species? Like if a villain is just evil and they're born that way and they're never going to be good, then what's the virtue in not being them? Do you know what I mean?
No, I get it. Yeah.
Like you need that spark of humanity. When you see somebody despicable, you kind of need to imagine how, if your circumstances have been similar, you could have been like them, because then it makes it impressive if you choose not to be like them. And I think that's the key to making like an emotionally honest, you know, pulpy adventure story. Otherwise you might as well just, you know, have them be orcs or something.
Right. They become completely two dimensional. You can't relate to them. But that, again, that's the tragedy of the character. Because he wasn't 100%, you know, evil, some sort of different species. I think when you start talking about, you know, psychopaths and serial killers, where they're so far out there, you have no touchstone. That's where it gets, you start not caring, right? Cause you can't relate. You're just like, yeah, they're bad and that's it. And that wasn't the case.
It's true. It's a funny thing. Like, I think since we are in a pop culture landscape now where every single one of our major creative people are people who learned how to create by watching other people's movies and TV shows and comics and things. So you watch people take the wrong lessons from those works. You know, for example, people love Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter. They love that character and they keep on trying to replicate that character. But that character's not the star of the movie. He's in like 20 minutes of the movie. It's the other characters that are like the prisms that we're seeing him through. He's right. Just a facet. And I think that it's important to know, you know, when your heartless monsters are like just a useful set piece and when they're an actual character you need to flesh out more.
Yeah, and there's that...
I mean, heck, they just won 2 Oscars for doing that to the Joker.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say, is that, you know, there's that school of thought that you can judge a hero by his villains. And as much as I think sometimes Batman is overused and overexposed, I can't argue that he has the best rogues gallery, and it reflects on who he is as a hero. When you look at the villains that he has, that he fights, and what they reflect, what they show of him as a hero.
Yeah, well said. That's sort of what we're trying to reverse engineer with Lavender Jack.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head in that first season, and I specifically have to ask you about episode 23. It had something that really threw me for a loop when I was reading it. Mimley is at this party, and there's other members of the Gallery High Society, and they're talking about Lavender Jack, and these different members of the High Society have their kind of theories about who Lavender Jack is, what his motivations are. And as they're describing them, all of a sudden we get these different iterations of Lavender Jack. And I didn't realize at first that they were other artists other than you doing the art and giving us these different iterations. So for a few moments there, I was like, wow, Dan really switching up his style. And then at the end, you give the credits. Talk to us about episode 23, who you got to help out with the art and those different iterations of Lavender Jack.
Oh, that was so much fun. That might be my favorite episode of season one. So there's in comics, this is called a jam issue, where you have several different artists come on to very visibly guest artist on the book. Like they're not supposed to assimilate the style of the book. They're supposed to look different. And I've always loved the idea of doing that because it's a way to work with some of your friends or just some people you admire in a small, manageable way. You know, you might not, like your schedules don't really mesh in such a way that you can do a whole issue of something together or a whole graphic novel. But I can definitely get people in to do one panel, especially if it's one panel with a very loose prompt. Like for instance, you know, one of the Lavender Jacks that one of the rich people at the party is theorizing is that he's this deplorable, despicable, like sewer person who's, you know, coming to steal their valuables. And so I just said essentially just that to my friend Lucas Kettner, who of course is the artist of wonderful books like Witch Doctor and Kill the Minotaur, both out of Skybound. And so I gave him that. I'm like, you got a month, run with it, do whatever you want. And then he turned in that awesome Bernie Wrightson style, like Rat King Lavender Jack. And that's so much fun for me to not know what I'm going to get. And then to get things like Odd Cook, one of my best friends, her amazing, you know, demon on top of the Night and Bald Mountain Fantasia style Lavender Jack, which is a hand painting, by the way. Even my girlfriend Jackie Cross showed up to do the Harlequin Jack. Now this was all inspired by the like Rosetta Stone for everything I do creatively, which is the 90s Scarlet Pimpernel Broadway musical. There's a number in the middle of the musical that's just the same plot as this episode. A bunch of rich people, one of whom is Sir Percy Blakeney, who is the Scarlet Pimpernel, are just singing the song where they're coming up with wild theories of who the Scarlet Pimpernel really is. You know, he's a Maharaja who's here in secret. You know, he's a serial killer. He's a sexy romance novel man. And I just wanted to capture that feeling, marry it to the fun of working with my friends and come up with an issue that I only had to draw 2/3 of. And it really came together, thanks in large part to Jen's cohesive coloring.
Yeah, she did a great job. I have to agree with you. I think it's my favorite episode of season. If not my favorite, it's definitely the most fun episode of season one. Because like you said, it's just great seeing these different iterations of Lavender Jack and seeing them through the eyes of these other very talented artists. I think it succeeded on every level.
Oh, I agree. And it's refreshing when it comes as well, because there have been some sort of dire episodes up to that point. And I feel like when you're doing something serial like this, you need to kind of have a sense of what you're doing to your audience emotionally. And, you know, sometimes it's a good time to, you know, pump the brakes on the thriller aspect of it and just play around a little bit.
Yeah, the other way you gave us a sort of a break, if you will, as readers, and you know, just kind of released attention a little bit, you did recap episodes periodically, and I thought they worked very well because it wasn't like comics were in the 70s and 80s when you get those like 1.5 to 2 pages of exposition, especially if you ever go back and read the first Marvel Superhero Secret Wars that Jim Shooter wrote. Mm-hmm. It's so obvious that you're just being spoon-fed what's happened so far. But you were able to put out these recap episodes, and they fit in the story, and it very much fit in with the character. A lot of times it was Madame Ferrier, and you established this early on. She liked to talk through, what do we know so far? It was part of her process. Was that why you came up with that that aspect of her personality? Did you know you were going to do these recap episodes? Did it happen organically? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, this one was completely organic. In the early on in episode 3, I think, is when Ferrier says to Crabbe for the first time, like, you know, let us say out loud what we know and see if we can learn something new from that. That was because I had just, I was sort of figuring out, I figured out something that makes detectives really engaging in fiction is when they teach you something. The example that gets brought up a lot is in The Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes story. Holmes is able to estimate the height of somebody who's written something on a wall, because when you write something at a wall, you write something at about the level of your eyes. And so as the reader, you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's true. So now I know a cool thing that Holmes taught me. And I thought, this is a fun philosophical thing that Ferrier does. You know, say what you know out loud, see if you detect something new in it just by hearing it out loud. And that sort of has that same ring to me of something that you can now apply to your life, reader. And then when we got to episode, I think it's 12 or 13, is the first recap one where Ferrier's talking to Crabbe. I think I'd hurt my back or something, and I just didn't have, I needed to give myself half a week off to recover from that. So I thought, hey, this is a fun way to reuse a bunch of art assets with very minimal, like, new framing device panels I'd have to draw. And it gives us a chance to kind of repackage the narrative for people who are just joining us. And that was the other thing. I mean, that's why we've done it, been versions of it several times since, this is long. This is, you know, if every episode of Lavender Jack is about 7 pages worth of normal comic book content, that means we're doing a whole issue every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the first season is 48 episodes long. So, like, I can't expect my readers, a lot of whom are younger, a lot of whom are, you know, teenagers, they're in schools, some of them are speaking English as a second language. I can't expect you to, you know, remember who Batten the banker is when you haven't seen him for 7 weeks. So I try to keep recirculating the information in new organic character-based ways so that you just kind of, it helps you It's the video game map of the series. It just helps you kind of remember where you are.
Yeah, I thought they were done exceptionally well, wildly successful. And I think one of the things that really helps Lavender Jack stand out and probably part of the reason you got the recognition that you got, because it's just done so well. And a happy accident, it sounds like.
Well, it's very flattering. Thank you. And that's one of the things we talked about, how it's like 75% of what I planned, but I think 90% effective. Mm-hmm. That's one of that bridging 15% of just embracing a useful solution.
Now, in terms of the nuts and bolts of your workflow, you mentioned 48 episodes, clearly, that ever present deadline. Was there anything that you learned as a creator in terms of your workflow? Anything that you changed as season one went on that helped you stay on top of those deadlines?
Well, absolutely. I still struggle with deadlines just because I sometimes let my ambition sort of run away from me. But I did learn. I learned a lot of important little things to do to make life easier on yourself. Like, okay, do these five characters need to be in this scene? Can it just be these three characters? And now I've just saved myself 3 hours by not having to draw those extra characters in these panels. I've given myself more room. So maybe this panel can have a little more dialogue in it. So now we don't have to do three panels. We can do it in two. I just got better at these little ways of condensing. And then some other stuff, like, don't give yourself something big and complicated to draw at the end of the episode. Because if you're going chronologically, if you're inking from beginning to end, then by the time you get there, that's when that's when you're starting to run out of time. You're getting tired. You're getting stressed out. And so maybe that's not the place to, all of a sudden a door is swung wide and we see a room full of people in hospital beds. Like maybe you're not going to have the spoons for that, right, at 11:25 on a Thursday night. So it's just a lot of little things like that that have made me. I don't know if I'm more efficient in the second season, but what I'm doing, I'm definitely doing in a more time effective way.
Do you feel like you're more comfortable with the vertical scroll now than when you first started? Has your feelings about the format evolved at all?
I definitely understand it better. I still don't think I understand it completely. I'm still learning. And sometimes I fall into ruts where I don't read a lot of other webtoons for a while. And I do myself an injury there because I start only thinking of doing the scrolling format my way. And I stopped paying attention to cool things that, Miranda Munt, for instance, is doing Unmuted, Air's Game is a comic that has really wonderful, like, high protein construction where it's chicken breast and brown rice. It's like, okay, you don't have to get fancy with it, but be consistent and you can build to something really complicated and cool. When I remember to keep my mind open, that's when I have an easier time. It's when I only try and think, okay, I've been doing this for 2 years. I know the vertical format. I don't need to, I have my formula. I can just do it my way. That's when I run into trouble because that's when I run into ruts.
Yeah. You've got to start, you've got to always challenge yourself and continue to evolve as an artist.
Yeah. And you can't do it in a vacuum. Just burn yourself out if you do it in a vacuum.
Yeah, 100%. And the other aspect of the art, you mentioned your colorist on the series, your collaborator, Jen Manley Lee, and what an incredible job she did on episode 23 of tying everything together. And I have to say that she really did a superb job of capturing the feel of the world and keeping the tone of the story consistent throughout. I think she's an incredibly talented color artist. Do you find that as season one went on and now into season two, that your collaboration is getting better? You guys have developed a shorthand and an even better understanding and a way to bring out the best in each other's work?
Very much so. Very much so. In fact, it's gotten to the point now where I don't even give her the scripts anymore. I just give her the black and white art, which has a notes layer on top. So I'll just write little things like, this is the light source. I think this might be yellow, but, you know, see what you want. And then we now have enough of a comfortable shorthand for that sort of thing that it's opened up new things we can do together. For instance, in season two, there's an episode. It's the first time we see Madame Ferrier in the season. And I want to do this scene. It's actually something that happened in my life. It's a memory I have, it's an experience I've had, where she's on a mountain and she looks down at a cloud bank and sees a rainbow from above. And when you see it from that angle, a rainbow is actually circular. And so I thought this would be a wonderful thing for her to see, because in storytelling terms, the lie Ferrier believes about herself is that she is near the end of her life, when really she has a lot of road left to go. And so her seeing a wonderful natural phenomena for the first time would be a great way to illustrate that as we reintroduce her. And so I did some tests of how to render it. And I realized that if I try and draw it in ink, it's not going to look like anything. It's going to look like a soggy, like a pineapple wedge in the sky. And so I sent Jen some reference material. On the notes, I drew a circle where I thought it might be. And I said, over to you. If you're up for it, I'd love to see what you can do. And she just like nailed it. We didn't have to go back and forth on it at all. She's like, oh yeah, sure. Rainbow from above. I know that because I'm Jen Manly Lee and I know everything. And bam, I think it's one of the great moments of season two so far. And that's the kind of thing that's possible because of the trust and familiarity that we've built up over the course of doing this thing for a year and a half.
Yeah, that episode of season two is probably my favorite one so far, just because I wasn't sure if Madame Ferrier was going to show back up. And then she did. And her in the Swiss Alps, the snow, and the rainbow. And what's funny is I think in the back of my mind, I knew that about rainbows, if you see them from above, but I had just read an article about some famous photographer who was on a mountain and had come across one of those and had taken a picture of it recently where his shadow, the light was such that his shadow was going so that the circular rainbow was surrounding his head of the shadow, and it looked like this angel. And I just had read that article like 2 days ago, and then I was like, oh, here we go, circular rainbow. That's so interesting. What a coincidence. So, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, wow.
Life works in funny ways like that.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you for telling me that. That's so fun.
Yeah. And again, I think Jen, very much deserving of praise, and I can't, and you probably feel the same way. I can't imagine anybody else coloring the strip, but her. She's done such a spectacular job all the way through.
I've actually had, I won't say who, but I've had other people, colorist friends of mine being like, hey Dan, does Jen ever get tired? Could I hop on an episode? And I've even brought up to Jen. I'm like, hey, do you need a break or something? She's like, no, this is my thing. She's really invested in it. And I guess I hoped that that would be true of her. And it was really nice to see that it was in fact true.
Yeah, it's great. But it's also great that you have, other people that recognize that it's something special and want to work on. At least that option's open to you if you ever need to take advantage.
Yeah, it is nice to know that, if one of us totally, if we get laid up or sick or otherwise taken off the board, that won't mean the whole thing has to shut down. We do have backup options.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I did also want
to obviously ask, I'm slightly less replaceable, but we make it work.
Yeah, I think you could have somebody step in. I'm sure you're at this point. You could think of a way to explain why the art looked a little different. So, but hopefully we don't have to discover that. But I did want to ask you, at what point did you know there was going to be a season two? There were a few episodes in the first season. There's kind of the question and answer ones. I love when Webtoon creators do this, and it's a chance to interact directly with fans and answer questions and kind of explain things. And in a couple of those, I think you mentioned that based on questions people asked, that you would love to go back and tell some prequel things of Madame Ferrier's earlier career. So at what point did you know there was going to be a season two, and did you know it was going to be something beyond just that idea of a prequel?
Well, with I think when we started thinking seriously about doing another season of something in the Lavender Jack universe, that was early last year, I guess. Yeah, so this time last year, and it started to look like Webtoon might be open to it, because Lavender Jack had started to build up this like super engaged kind of cult audience, and so they're like, we'll do another season. That's why not. So I knew I had an idea for a Lavender Jack season two, like a direct continuation with all the same characters. And I knew I had an idea for a Theresa Ferrier origin series. And so I was sort of developing both at the same time. For Lavender Jack season two, I was really inspired by the Batman Telltale series of point and click games. I thought that, I really liked the feel of those, and I was interested in doing something that sort of took some cues from that, that examined the characters in a bit more of a human way. And then on the Ferrier front, I was really delighted at the idea of doing more of a grounded, more of a less tropey version of what we'd done in Lavender Jack, something that was a little bit more human and tackled social issues a little bit more, and that dipped into a period of French history that I'm really fascinated by. And really all it came down to was that Lavender Jack season two kind of came together conceptually faster than Theresa Ferrier did. I landed on something that I really started to like. I like the villain, the Black Note, the sort of central fixture of the season. He really started to come together, and the idea of doing something that was a little bit more political and a little more reflective of just conversations I was having at the time, it just seemed like that's something I could deliver to a higher degree of quality faster. So we decided to put our energies behind that. But I still have a lot of material that I built up for a Theresa Ferrier series. And I am very committed to doing that as soon as possible.
Well, we mentioned that Madame Ferrier does show up in season two. I wasn't sure she was going to, so I was glad to see her there. She's an interesting character, so obviously look forward to reading tales of they're specifically focused on her. But I'm loving season two so far. I have to imagine there is a challenge in keeping it fresh with season two, being that, you know, we're seeing so many of the same characters, we have the same setting. So is that a challenge? Is that the biggest challenge in season two, making sure that you are doing something different and not repeating yourself?
I think that part actually came pretty easy, because I knew early on that the big idea of season two would be, in season one, Theresa Ferrier was our explicit protagonist, and Lavender Jack was introduced as a soft antagonist, as like if this was Killing Eve, he'd be Villanelle. That's sort of the role he had in the first season. So in season two, we're going to bump both Lavender Jack and Inspector Crabbe up to protagonist roles. They were going to like to co-helm season two. And as soon as I thought that, it really recontextualized a bunch of stuff. I knew that I had to take Madame Ferrier off the board for a little bit, because if Jack and Crabbe were going to be our main characters, I knew that their doubt and the differences between them were going to be big motivating factors. And if Teresa Ferrier was there, there would be sort of a chaperone for them. And I wanted to remove that for a little bit. I also wanted to remove this amazing detective for a while, because she's kind of like Gandalf, where she, if she is given too much room to operate, she might end things too early, or just remove the need for other characters to do things she could do. You know, like, I don't think Crab would be growing as much as she is in season two if Ferrier was there.
Yeah,
that's in terms of freshness. I think it kind of happens organically. There's other things that I struggle with, but I like to think it's pretty fresh.
Yeah, I was going to say that the growth of Crab, her getting more screen time, us kind of getting an insight into kind of her thoughts and motivations and the way she sees herself, it's been refreshing. It's been something that's different, and I do expect to see more. I mean, obviously she had an arc in the first season, but I see her growing even more in the second season. You yourself mentioned earlier that when we're first introduced to Crab, she's somewhat two dimensional. She's a little, like you said, kind of that boring, lawful good character. Throughout season one, she became more complex and more interesting. And it really does seem like you're building on that in season two.
Yeah, I think that in a lot of ways, Crab is, she's sort of our most moral character. Like she has a very clear idea of right and wrong. And we kind of watch her struggle with how to square the circle of, I'm a cop, I follow the law, and I serve the city. But right now, the guy in charge of the city is not somebody we can trust. So I have to break the law. I have to work with this vigilante to protect the spirit of the law if I can't follow the letter. And I think that's a super fascinating conflict to explore, because it means that the only people she can really talk to are Ducky and Mimley, you know, Team Lavender Jack. But the fact that she has to work with them is a big compromise of her principles. And I think that, like, that automatically was a great place to put a protagonist. And that freed up Mimley to have more of an internal arc, since he kind of gets to start the season from a position of strength, where, you know, he's Lavender Jack. He's doing pretty good. He's fighting crime. He's a handsome billionaire. He gets to have an arc that's more based about, you know, ennui, and as opposed to Crab's very visceral, like, nuts and bolts external arc.
Yeah, well, we don't want to give too much away, but it definitely seems like you are throwing some obstacles in Mimley's way. He's not having the best time, even from characters you might think would naturally be his ally, that are somewhat of a roadblock that we just saw recently. So it's been very interesting. What has you most excited about the upcoming season? We don't want to get too spoilery, but what are you really anxious for the readers to experience about this season two?
I think the big mystery of the season is, who is the Black Note? Who is this, like, the first real supervillain that we've had in the season? Who's behind the mask? But also, you know, if we find out who's behind the mask, what would the ramifications of that be? As the season continues and you kind of see how characters are interrelated, I feel like you will reach a point where it feels like there's no emotionally right answer. Where, like, there isn't one person you can point to, like, you, I hate you, and I know you're the note, and we're going to find out you're the note, and I'm so excited to watch you fail. It's going to be more complicated than that, and I'm excited to see my loyal, intelligent readers in pain.
I love it.
That season two is a machine designed to hurt your feelings.
Fair enough. Can't wait to see how it all turns out. I'm a big fan of the series, big fan of your work, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join me, Dan. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I'll just give you one last question here. If there's anything you want to add about the Webtoon platform itself, and anything that you want to say to your loyal readers.
Well, about Webtoon, I'll say that you know, we're rounding out. If we start from the very beginning of when production started on Lavender Jack season one, this is now 2 years that I've been working for Webtoon, and it has been a really great 2 years. It's been we've struck up a really great relationship, and I think it's very. It's easy when you're trying to hit deadlines every week and, you know, you got to say no to hanging out with people, or, you know, you got to say no to sitting on the couch with your girlfriend and, you know, watching Watchmen or whatever. It's easy to forget what a gift it is to have this company footing the bill for the comic I most want to make right now with this tremendous, editorial freedom I'm given, this incredible reach to reach so many people. It's sort of unprecedented. Like you could not conceive of this if you were doing comics around the time I was born. This is genuinely disruptive in the tech sense. And then speaking of those readers, I'm just so glad people are sticking around for this comic. I see the arguments and the theories in the comments, and what strikes me is A, nobody knows how to spell Crab's name, and that's fine, I'm okay with it, and B, it's that everybody is so like positive and constructive with each other. Like there's nobody in there saying noxious stuff. There's nobody in there being like just like posting bad memes. And whenever somebody starts to do something approaching that, they get downvoted into oblivion. It's a wonderful little community that supports and reads this comic. And I just feel so lucky to have attracted them to it. I'm very, very happy to have the audience that I have.
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes to the quality of the community that is on Webtoon, because it's something I hear from a lot of creators. So again, Dan, thanks for joining me. Congratulations on the success of season one, and continued success with season two. I'm loving it, and I can't wait to see how it all turns out.
I can't wait to hear what you think of it, man. Thank you so much for having me back on.
It's my pleasure. And everybody, don't forget, you can go to the show notes, give Dan a follow on social media. His Twitter, his Instagram. You can go check out his website, and be sure you go to Webtoon and check out season two of Lavender Jack. So thanks again, Dan, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Looking forward to it.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.